I'm Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with me Dr. Thomas Moore, and we're going to talk about two books of his in particular, Care of the Soul and The Dark Night of the Soul. How are you, Dr. Moore?
Hello.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
How are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Thanks for coming on my show tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Before we get started, tell us just a little bit about you. Tell people how to find you and what you do and how you got where you are.
That's a bit of a story. I lived in a Catholic religious order when I was young. I left when I was 13, left home to enter a seminary. And so I lived in this monastic life for about 13 years. Wandered around a bit to try to find my way when I left it, and then ended up getting a PhD in religion. So I taught religion and psychology in the university for a number of years, and then became a therapist, a psychotherapist. And finally, I turned to full-time writing, which is what I'm doing now.
Well, you and I, and where can people find you?
They can find me on a website called careofthesoul.net, and they can also find some of my writings at a blog called Bark, B-A-R-Q-U-E. So it'll be Bark, blogspot.com.
Okay. Well, you normally have had a conversation, I know most of my guests, through the science of consciousness and such, but you and I don't know each other, and so I'm going to share with you a story. About a decade ago, I had a very dark night of the soul, and I wasn't aware of spirituality. I was a fundamental Baptist at the time. I didn't know anything about consciousness, and I didn't know anything about spirituality, but I stumbled across your book, The Dark Night of the Soul book, and it helped me a lot at the time. And what happened was I'd had my child kidnapped, and my father died, and I became pregnant, and all within 6 weeks, and I lost my job all in 6 weeks' time. And so the book really helped me, and I got mixed into my bookshelf, and I hadn't seen it in years. And I was looking through there the other day, and I saw that book, and I went, oh, my God, it's that time in my life again. I feel like I'm on the edge. I feel like a shift is happening. Something's happening. And I had a spontaneous enlightenment along the way as well, which woke me up dramatically. So you've been on my shelf for a very long time and played a big role in my life. But I just recently stumbled across you again. I thought, oh, my God, I have to have this man to talk about dark nights of the soul, because so many people I know are having them, particularly now with the economy and changes in their life. So I would like, if you could tell us, what is a dark night of the soul?
Well, it varies from person to person and from different times of your life. It's what I mean by it is that it's a period in life when you experience loss or failure. Something bad happens. And you go through a long period, and you wish, you know, things would get better, get back to normal. And most people are advised and think that what they should do is to, try to get back into life and to use everything at their disposal to be normal again. And what I recommend is different. I recommend that a dark night, it could be an illness or it could be a divorce, it could be a lot of things, loss of a job, dark night is an initiation. It's going through something that can make you more of who you are or make you a better person. And the whole idea then is to try to have some patience with it and let it do its work and be guided by the feelings that you have when you're in this dark place and resist the temptation that you get from everyone else, to resist the temptation to get out of it as soon as possible.
What is the, is there a difference between the dark night and just general depression?
Well, I think there is. The word depression is used to cover an awful lot. Today, a lot of people think immediately of depression whenever they feel sad. We don't use these ordinary words anymore, you know, that are more specific. Like you say, I really feel lost, or I feel I'm emptied out, or I feel like life is really treating me badly. Instead, we say we're depressed, and it doesn't say much. You know, it doesn't say a whole lot. I do believe there's such a thing as clinical depression, but I think most people, when they go through a dark night, are not in a clinical depression. They're going through what is quite an ordinary period in life when things are bleak and dark and empty. And so I think the thing to do is to treat it as a human experience and not just treat it as a medical situation, and try to find some meaning in it and find your way through it rather than just try to get rid of it.
So if someone says to me, a woman came to see me today, and she, a young woman, and she said, my husband left me, he took all my money, my father abused me when I was a child. And I said, I don't want to hear that. Stop telling me about it. You know, stop thinking. She said, what button did I push to stop thinking? So how do they start?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, behind every dark night of the soul is a story of some kind. Like, that's a story in itself. And what I would do is begin by listening to the person's story. That gives the person a chance to be heard, which is really a very important thing. And also to give some specific details to what's going on. So you have so that it becomes a human experience instead of just saying this is a syndrome or this is a problem like anyone else has. The story makes it individual. It fits it into your life and the other stories in your life. And all of that is an achievement. Even though it sounds very simple, it's quite an achievement to be able to tell the story of what's going on and to connect it up with other things that have happened in life. I know that the example you just gave, you know, a person could sort of dig a pit, keep getting, you know, deeper and deeper into the sadness of it all. But in a way, maybe that's what we have to do. You know, we have to realize what our fate is and what has happened to us and find someone that we can talk to about it. I mean, that's what psychotherapy is. You just, you know, you find a therapist who will listen to you and listen intelligently.
So did you have, what was your experience of the dark night? How did you learn all of this?
Well, I feel like I've been in plenty of them myself. Not the same ones that other people tell, and maybe not as extreme as some, but, you know, certainly through enough. I think that one of the most difficult dark nights I've been through was to get divorced many years ago. I think that's a really tough thing for people to have to go through. Sometimes going through an illness. Just a few years ago, I was diagnosed with some heart problems, and suddenly I felt like the bottom just dropped out. You know, I had so much that I wanted to do, and my family is young and growing, and I had to face my mortality. That's a dark night as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think they just keep coming at you. You know, I don't think you have to go looking for them. You know, they just keep popping up in life, and it's part of life. That's the point. It's part of life, and it's an illusion to think that you should have a life that doesn't have any darkness in it.
Do you think that there are any preceding events that's letting you know that a dark night, when talking about human consciousness,
mm-hmm.
like this, when I say consciousness, I mean the ground of all being, or the source of all there is, maybe. Do you think there's anything that precedes the dark night of the soul that you can watch for to maybe keep it from happening? Like, I guess when I read spiritual books, sometimes they say things start happening, illnesses start happening, you know, relationships start having problems, things like that. Have you observed that?
Well, I wouldn't want to be too mystifying about that. I think that, on the other hand, I do think that you can get a sense that you know, that things are going badly. Certainly people have that feeling. They say, look what's happened. Suddenly everything was fine. For, you know, maybe for several years things were just really fine and happy. And suddenly it seems like trouble begins to come, and it comes in bunches, and it doesn't stop. Or I think it is possible to feel that maybe that you are in a bad place suddenly, and so a lot of bad things happen, and you can intuitively sense they're coming because you know deep down that you're not, maybe not in the right place in your life, that you've, you know, that you've, like someone recently, just the other day, told me that she was in a dark night of the soul and very, very down, and she knew what the problem was, and she knew what she had to do, but she couldn't do it. You know, she just couldn't bring herself to make the changes that she would have to in her life. And I hear that from a lot of people. So in that state, a person may say, well, you know, I'm setting myself up for more trouble. And they know they're doing it, but they can't do anything about it. So I do think that it's possible to intuitively be aware that some bad things may be coming along. But I don't myself, I don't see spirituality as being quite so mystical, you know. I don't know if I should put it that way, but I mean that I'd rather stick with the more ordinary ways we have of understanding our lives and not try to be superhuman about it.
Okay. So you also talk about when you come out of the dark night of the soul, and I'm putting this in my own words, that you may not feel like you belong,
yes,
or that you don't fit in. Can you talk about that some?
Yes, well, that's part of it, I think. You know, when you when things are going well, usually you're able to be, you know, happy with friends and family and co-workers and people like that. But when things start going badly and you sink into one of these dark nights, part of it is to be alone in it, I think. That's part of the problem. It's not easy. It's not easy to find people to talk to. It's not easy to express yourself to people. You can be easily misunderstood. And then a lot of people don't want anyone around them who's sad or going through something that is not happy. You know, especially I think in America, we have sort of an American devotion to happiness. And if a person is not happy and cheerful, then you think there's something wrong. And I think that's difficult then for us, any of us, when we get into one of these dark nights, because we might feel alone. It's difficult to connect with other people. They'd prefer it if we could maybe cover up our unhappiness. So that's part of the experience of being alone. And I think another one is, like, when you get sick. I've been working in medicine a lot lately and working in hospitals. When people get sick, especially seriously ill, there's a strong feeling of being alone in that situation because nobody else is experiencing it. Everyone else you see is well, and they're doing well, living their lives, and you are the person who is sick and has to be taken away from normal life. So in a lot of these experiences, I think there's a feeling of not belonging anymore to the community that you're used to, and that itself is cause for some pain.
Yeah, I agree with you. And another thing that I would like, you talk about in your book that after you have a dark night of the soul and you start moving on through your life, that you get some kind of broader, deeper vision.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think's going on there?
Well, when you have,
and what does that mean?
Well, when you have something going on in your life that's sad and happy, you have a loss, a number of things happen. One is that you become part of the human race. You know, I mean, like all of us, or at least most of us, have to go through these things. And if you haven't, or if you haven't done it much, you've been spared. But when you do, I think people around you will think, well, now you know what it's like to be human. We all go through these difficult times. You know what it's like when you're around people who haven't had any bad experiences, it seems? Like they don't seem quite real, and it's difficult to connect to them. So I think part of this experience of the dark night is this feeling of it's you discover that you're part of the human race. Another big thing that happens is that when you're in a bad, dark place, your thinking changes. I know this from going to hospitals. People then say, so often say, now I've discovered what's important in my life. Now that I'm really sick, now I've discovered what's important. Many people say they've discovered that their family is more important than they realized, or certain friends are more important. Your sense of values gets shuffled up and reoriented, so certain things come to the top that weren't at the bottom before. Now, that's a shift in thinking and a shift in imagination, and it's crucial because that's where you find meaning. So a person who's gone through a dark night of the soul, who has had to reflect on things and consider what's important and how to deal with life and what they're going to do, just for having gone through it, having reflected that way, they're better off than when they started.
I think it made me less material.
Mm-hmm.
I was terribly materialistic mm-hmm. until it happened, and it took it all away, took away a lot of my ego. I want to move back to what I said a minute ago about telling the woman I didn't want to hear it. I don't mean that I don't want to hear it one, you know, I want to hear the story.
Right.
I mean, every time I see this woman, she tells me the story.
Yeah.
It's somebody that I ran into at my child's school.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that it helps to keep talking about it, something that you can't change, that you can't do anything about, or should you, do you advise people to get into the moment and leave it after a while, or does it help to keep telling the story until
well,
it wears out?
I think I see what you mean. Some people, you know, it's like they're a one-story person, and all they can do is keep telling how, you know, how sad life has been for them, and after a while, people get tired of hearing it. That certainly happens. And you don't want, you wish that some people would just, you know, get over it and, you know, and finally let life go on because they're so attached to it. But apparently they haven't had the insight yet to be able to move on. You know, they haven't really told their story. That's my guess.
Uh-huh.
Having done therapy, you know, for a long time, what I see over and over again is that people think that they are telling their story and saying what's happening to with them.
Uh-huh.
And but really they haven't gone very deep. You know, they keep repeating the same story, but they don't go deeper with it. And I see my role as a therapist to try to help a person deepen their story so that they don't keep repeating the same story over and over again. I mean, it's the same tale of what's happened to them. But by listening and by saying a few things, I can try to deepen the story so that it goes deeper all the time. And in that way, I think the story can come to an end. Finally, you reach a point where you don't have to keep telling it anymore. The reason you repeat it is that you don't go anywhere with it.
Yes. Okay. Now, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions that's outside of your book. I think, honestly, I got stuck on the first half of it. That's where I found some relief, I guess. I didn't finish the back, and I don't know if this is in there or not. But I'd like to know what you, since I know that you said it's religion, do you think that thought creates, and by thinking this over and over and over, telling the story over and over and over, and living it, that you can create that life? Does that make sense?
Well, I think here's what I think you can. I think imagination is really the core of it all. So, if you can reimagine your life to some extent, then it will change because you can't change unless you can imagine it some way. You know, and if you're in the same old place, always seeing the world from the same viewpoint over and over again, nothing's going to change. Nothing's going to happen. So there has to be something to spur a shift in imagination. That's really crucial. And what does it take to do that? Sometimes when people do go through a bad experience, they suffer a loss. Like I said, when people get sick, suddenly their imagination might shift. Sometimes when people are divorced, they see things differently, and they try to live a different life. I've talked to a number of people in the past couple of years who lost a child, you know, whose child died, and usually from an illness of some kind, and their life changed radically. You know, they saw everything entirely differently. So it's whatever it takes to shift the imagination is really what's important. That's why I value this work of therapy so much, because, you know, people are in trouble, and I think most of us have a hard time seeing what we are, what we're going through. We need some help. We need someone to reflect back to us what they hear from us and what they see is going on. And through, for me at least, through quite a lengthy conversation over and over again, very slowly people began to see things differently, and that makes all the difference, that they really do change.
Have you seen any indication in your work that there's any kind of cycle to it? And I guess what I mean here is, from a soul's perspective, and something that I read about Kabbalah one time, about there being 7-year cycles in the souls for you to learn, you know, whatever you're supposed to learn. So have you seen cycles that come with dark nights of the soul?
Yes, I think that...
Does that make sense, too?
Yes, it does. There are many, many religious and spiritual systems that talk about cycles. You know, it's like the Saturn return, the astrologers say, you know. I think that's a good way to look at things. That I think normally the way modern people, you know, kind of in the materialistic scientific world we're in, tend to always see things as evolving in a straight line rather than coming in circles. I do think that the life of the soul works in circles and cycles. And so the same thing would be true of dark nights. You may have a really bad experience at one point, and then you have this long period where everything seems to be in order and everything's fine. You think it's going to be that way for the rest of your life, and suddenly some new thing comes along, and it can feel like a repetition or a recycling of what happened before, because now you're thrown back into a similar kind of challenge. I went through that myself. I loved the university teaching, and I was fired from the job after 7 years, and I was really shocked and didn't know what to do. And went through it, got through it, and actually things were a lot better after a while, having gone through that. And now I'm really happy that, you know, I didn't stay teaching in the university. But and then things were quite normal and happy for quite a few years, and then this heart stuff appears, you know, and I had to suddenly really pay attention to my health in a way that I didn't have to before, and feeling older and all of that. So, but it feels like a recycling. You know, it's like, okay, once again now, I'm going to have to re-examine my life. I'm going to feel that things are not moving ahead smoothly, and it's not the same in all those details, but there is something similar. And I think that is where the sense of cycles of the soul come in.
Mm-hmm. And I'd also like for you to talk about it. You said something in this book that struck me one day. It's not only you going through the dark night of the soul, but your family goes through it with you, whether you realize it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like for you to talk about that a little bit, because I think your perspective gets foggy when you're in the hole.
Well, it does.
I think you're the only one hurting.
It does. That's right. It kind of throws us into ourselves. As I was saying before, you get thrown into yourself and you lose touch with the world around you to some extent. And there's a bit of self-pity and masochism sometimes in that dark night, too, where you think, well, the world's, you know, against me and no one understands me. It's very easy to get into that place. And that's fine. That's just part of it. But then the family is there, and family members and close friends usually want the best for you. And I always say they tend to give you kind of bad advice, but at least they're trying. You know, they're trying to be happy and to get on with life. It's unusual, I think, to find friends who will just be there as you go through the thing and not try to push you ahead, you know, who will just be there, but just accompany you in whatever is going on. That's unusual, but it's very valuable. But I think that's true, we are not these individual spheres. You know, we don't stop at the ends of our skin, of our bodies, and part of our very nature, I would use a soul language there, that our soul is not just contained within our body, it reaches out into our family. So there's a family soul, and there's a community of people that we're connected with. And so when we go through a dark night, it's not just a single person going through it. Other people feel it. They experience it vicariously. They feel so close to you that they are affected by it. And even for themselves, they would like things to get better. So I think it's not so individual as we think, and it might help to know that and to try to share the experience to some extent.
Do you think that dark night for the soul can also be a result of some kind of nutritional deficiency, say magnesium or serotonin or carnitine or something?
I don't think I understood just what you meant there. Could you repeat
that? Yeah. Sometimes people get in deep, dark depressions and nothing's happened.
Yes. Oh, I see.
So could it be some nutritional deficiency?
Oh, yes, sure. Sure, it could be a lot of things. It could be nutrition. It could be unresolved issues from the past, you know, that you're not at all conscious of. As we go through life, I think we are always bumping into our past, and we don't even know it. The thing is that it's largely unconscious to us. So we might go through some experiences that waken the feelings, but we don't even know what's going on. So I think very often the dark night comes on, it sort of creeps into your life, and you don't know where it came from. Sometimes there may be no indication, like you're feeling your health is okay and, you know, your marriage is fine, the family's okay, the work seems to be okay, but you just feel in this dark place. It's like a mood that comes over you.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's, however, I do think even in that case, it's a good idea to continue to look at your life and look for some meaning in it rather than just take it as something that is either just physical or something that will just remain vague. I think it does help to explore it, to reflect on it, and talk about it.
Another thing: are you familiar with David Hoffman's work? That power versus force work.
No.
I'm going to ask you something outside of your book again, just because I know your life's been about soul work.
Yeah.
Do you think that there are gradients, I'm going to call it consciousness, conscious understanding, but it would be perception of a soul, I guess. You know, levels where, well, it's hard to put this in the word. Well, I guess David Hawkins has this book where he talks about 11 levels of conscious awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know, do you think that dark nights of the soul fall in more, in one level more than another? And it would be, the first level would be the kind where, no matter, it's like talking to a telephone pole if you're trying to tell somebody something about spirituality. And the top level would be, say, enlightenment. Does that make any sense to you?
I have to know his system. I can say, to try to answer your question though, I can say that I do think that there are certainly levels of the darkness that we get into. Just to say the obvious, there are some dark periods that don't last long and they're not too serious, but we go through them and feel them. It might just be waking up one day and realizing you have to go to the dentist. You know, that's a pretty dark morning. I mean, you know, it doesn't have to be huge. But then there are those times when the darkness seems to really strike at the very core of your being, you know, and everything's at stake. And as I say, the bottom falls out and you don't, you know, you no longer have any grounding to stand on, so it can be very anxiety provoking as well as lowering your mood. So I do think there are levels of seriousness, and that there's certainly levels of awareness that you can look at in your life. Now what happens is that the spiritual traditions and the systems, either the ancient ones or the new ones, give us all kinds of models for this. You know, there are many, many ways of saying there are, you know, 12 levels, or there are 5 levels, or, you know, different things of that sort. You know, for some people, like the Kabbalah, might use one particular system that way, or astrology uses different levels. All of these I would not take literally and say, okay, there are five or there are six or you have to choose one or the other. But what they tell us is that there are many levels in our experience. There are many dimensions to our experience, and that's very valid and important. And whatever system works for you, I would suggest following it. You know, that's fine. It can be useful. I would just not take it too literally. But I would definitely realize that or live in such a way that you know that there are levels to your awareness and levels to the intensity and depth of your feeling. And there are levels to the degree to which your life is falling apart. That's certainly true. And part of reflecting on them and making sense of them is to sort that out and say, well, how bad is this? And what level am I at? And what kind of a person am I? And what is this doing to me? That's part of the reflection.
Do you think that my show is really a science-based show, but I have to ask you these questions since you come study the religion and spirituality. Do you think the soul chooses the struggles that it encounters in physical reality before it gets here? Do you think it plans it and knows it and before it comes?
Well, you know, I'm going to do the same thing I've been doing. I hope you don't mind. I'm going to sort of reframe, in order to answer, just reframe it a little bit. I don't want to say just, oh, yes, the soul knows. I don't know what that means exactly. But what I can say is that that we are individual people and that there is a sense of destiny and fate to us. I remember the day when my daughter, who is 17 now, when she was born and I saw her, you know, for the first time, and I was very aware that... Now, this person is complete. I mean, here's somebody who has a whole life in front of her, and I don't think she is like this empty basket that's got to be filled up. She's an individual with a great, you know, with a destiny, with potential, with abilities and talents, and maybe some areas where she'll be weak at. And she's like that, and that will unfold throughout her life. So in that sense, I think you might say the soul chooses its dark nights. Her dark nights are going to be different from mine. That's obvious already. She has an illness herself now, an autoimmune illness she has to deal with. Now that was, you know, that was kind of in her fate from the very beginning. And in a way you can say that her soul chose that and something she has to deal with. And I think it will be to her, you know, it'll be painful and it worries me, but I think it will give her a lot as she goes along. She will be, and is already showing that she's particularly sensitive to people through her illness. So in that sense, I think the soul chooses its dark nights.
Okay, now I also want to touch on some of your other books, your Dark Eros book and The Soul of the Sex, but nobody talks about that.
All right.
So I want to see if you would just share a little bit about that. I haven't read those books. I don't have those books, but I'd like for you to say whatever it is that you've been writing about.
These two books are interesting to me. They're important books for me to have written. One, The Dark Eros, would be difficult for a lot of people to read. It's mainly useful for therapists who have to deal with some really tough situations with their clients. I mean, one thing I learned being a therapist is that there's no easy case. You know, everyone is complicated most people go through very, very difficult times. So I wrote this book, Dark Eros. It's based on the fiction of the Marquis de Sade, which is very, very dark. And I don't recommend it to anybody. It's very dark. But I think that what he was doing as a fictional writer, and I think he was very aware of what he was doing, was to try to explore the sadism and the masochism, desire we have to suffer. There's a kind of a longing for suffering and even a pleasure in suffering. And he was trying to explore all those things. So I wrote this book based on his fiction, taking him seriously as a fictional writer who wanted to explore these aspects of human life. And so people, especially therapists, can read this and maybe get some insight into aggression and violence and of the strong conflicts that you see in marriages and in families, especially or on our streets. So that's what that was about. And it's not an easy book. It's a very challenging book. The other one, The Soul of Sex, is much lighter in a way. It's trying to see that our sexuality is really at the very center of what goes on in our lives for all of us. It's very, very important to get our sexuality sorted out and straightened out. And so there's a book about not about sex as biology, but about the soul of sex, about the fantasies that are connected up with our sexuality and what we're trying to do in our sexuality, and sex as kind of a doorway into life. And as we deal with various sexual issues, we're really shaping our lives and trying to find out what is important and who we are. So it's a book that tries to look at sexuality in this deep way, and much more poetic way than it's usually considered.
When you wrote your Dark Eras book in the research or study or meditation, whatever you did, is there something that you found that provokes this, the desire to suffer from people? Does it start when they're a child, or is it something that happens when they get older?
Well, I think most of the time it appears to me that people are in a, if they're masochistic, if they tend to suffer and to allow people to push them around or cause them suffering, that is in them almost from the beginning. It doesn't seem to be something that just comes along late in life. You know, it's something that's been there all along, a pattern, a tendency. And you can see it, and you can track it to the family patterns and what goes on in family, and maybe to early experiences, but I think especially to family patterns. If you grew up with parents who are rather passive and allow people to make decisions for them and do things that are, you know, where they don't have much power or feel disempowered, then it's very likely that you will... Unless you have some enlightenment, you know, sometime you wake up and say, well, this isn't working, you probably will carry on that kind of pattern. I don't mean to say that we are determined entirely by our parents, but that is a factor. So to answer your question, I think generally speaking that it's something that is in our character. It's with us all the time.
Well, do you think that, and I don't know how to word this, linguistics is a problem here, is there a defective soul, do you think, or do you think that it's something that the soul chose to do, to learn a lesson?
Well, you see, the way I see it, this it's like a continuum from having too much power to having not enough power. That's like a long line. It'd be nice if we were in the middle somewhere, but not in a middle point that's absolute. I think there's a range. And it varies in the circumstances we're in. But some people tend to find it easy to exercise a power, you know, to be powerful and they love positions of power. Other people find it very difficult and would much rather follow and be told what to do. But there's a range in the middle there somewhere. So it's not a defective soul, really. I mean, unless it's really extreme, where people really do get masochistic in the extreme, and their lives are a mess because of it. That would be, as you say, kind of an illness of the soul. Mm-hmm. But it's also an illness of the soul if you're going to want to push people around all the time and don't show any vulnerability, but only try to be aggressive in your power, exercise of power. So that would be also an illness of the soul. Most of us are somewhere in between, and we bounce back and forth. And sometimes, in some situations, we have some power, and other situations, we have very little. That's just the way it is for most human beings. I think it's helpful in looking at our relationships in marriage and teachers and doctors and that sort of thing to reflect on power and see what our tendency is, and to see what our range is, and to track it and see, well, can you find some influences maybe that have directed you in this way? All of that reflection helps to make you a bit more conscious and be able to shape the life that you think is one that you want to live and that matches your ideals.
Okay, I have two more questions I'm going to tell you so I don't forget, because I get caught up listening to you and I forget my train of thought. So I'm just going to say them first. One of them is, it's so hard to put this in words. If you're, you know, based on quantum mechanics, to whatever degree, you know, energy doesn't stop, it just changes form. So whatever degree you have this energy, the pendulum is going to swing back and go in the opposite direction to the same degree. So I want to know, do you think it's better to live life passionately? Or do you think it's because to whatever degree you're going to have bliss, you're going to have that same degree of misery at some point, the dark night of the soul? Or should you try to walk down the middle of the road? And then the other thing I want you to talk about, let me see what time it is we've got here. It's 10:42, so we've got about 17 minutes. Could you talk a little bit about narcissism? What makes somebody narcissism? How do you make it better? How do you identify it in yourself? How do you accept it within yourself?
Narcissism, are you saying?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me mention something about being passionate first. Yes, I think we ought to be passionate. Sometimes people listen to me and they say, oh, are you talking about balance? And I never use the word balance because that seems too easy and there's no passion in balance. At least I haven't found too much in it. So I think it's much better to be passionate with whatever you're doing. And if the cost of that passion is some misery here and there, then that's just the way it has to be, I guess. You have to pay a price for your passions. But I think it's much more important to be passionate, to be a person of feeling, of vision, risking, taking risks, and being willing to pay for the risks by maybe making mistakes and suffering some losses that will pull you down. But then you can go through them and come back into your passionate life more intelligently and more creatively. I mean, I understand the middle way of Buddhism. I understand that the middle way there makes sense in the sense that we don't want to be on the total extremes all the time. But I don't think you have to be extreme to be passionate. You can be passionate and still be walking the Buddhist middle way. If I can say something then about narcissists and narcissism.
Absolutely.
I'm very interested in the story because Narcissus is a wonderful story. Itself, a story of a boy who starts out being very tough and hard and no one can connect with him, and then he finds himself in a pool of water, falls in love with his own image, and discovers that he's a lovable person, and then is transformed into a flower, the Narcissus flower. So I think that story tells us the whole picture of narcissism. As I see it, narcissism, which is widespread, is a failure to feel like you're somebody, that you're really you're someone who is significant and has a place in life and is recognized by people and has some honor and respect. I think that we need these things badly. That's why it's so important to give each other these expressions of this kind of thing. It's so important to express our appreciation of somebody when we feel it, because that exchange and community of respect and honor and appreciation is a good tonic. It's a good way of getting over the narcissism that we have. It's very concrete and very useful. So narcissist person is someone who doesn't really love himself. That's what the myth says. And once they learn to appreciate who they are and what talents they have and so on, the narcissism tends to vanish.
I never realized that about people.
Mm-hmm.
I had a very narcissistic husband. We got divorced, and I didn't look at it that way. I thought he loved himself too much.
Yes.
And really, he didn't love himself at all.
That's right. I think those two go together. You know, when a person really despises himself or has no good reason to appreciate who he is and doesn't feel that the world is appreciating him and giving him respect and honor, that person is going to respond by insisting too much on himself and doing it himself and trying hard to get that respect, too hard, and maybe talking about himself too much and just thinking of himself as being so great because he doesn't really feel that way. So the surface of narcissism would look like someone who loves himself too much, but actually beneath it there's a great emptiness.
Well, it makes me feel kind of guilty.
No, I don't think it's your job to change that person's narcissism at all. I think the best thing we can do sometimes is not play along with the person, and that's why we end relationships. In my book Soulmates, I have a chapter on ending where I think it's important to talk about and appreciate the how relationships end and not be sentimental and think they should never end.
Oh, thank you. I needed to hear that because I feel guilty sometimes because I drew the line. And I think after what you said, I went, oh, maybe I should have just tolerated it.
No.
Okay. All right. There's something here in this book I want to talk about, ritualistic and addictions. If you choose not to become involved in ritual, some form of compulsive, repeated behavior may enter your life. Why is that? And how do you fix that?
Well, what I wanted to do was connect a ritual in religion, like wedding ritual or going to church or saying prayers, that sort of thing, to connect it with ritualism that you see in people who are like psychotic people or when we become neurotic, we sometimes engage in ritual behavior.
I didn't mean that. I knew what you meant, like meditations or something good, a good thing that you do every day, right?
Oh, you're asking me about rituals?
Yeah. Well, you said if you don't get some kind of ritual, then you're probably going to get some addiction to come into your life. Could you explain that? Because I think that's very important, and I think you're right on target with that, at least from what I've observed in my own life.
Yes, well, ritual is so important to, it's a spiritual activity that directs our attention away from ourselves. And like a ritual of prayer, as you say, meditation or yoga, or there are lots of rituals that we can engage in. Maybe just taking a walk every day at a certain place. I have a ritual where I walk my dog every morning for about 40 minutes and stop and talk to the people at the cemetery we pass. It's a ritual for me.
Like you start seeking something if you don't feel that.
I think if you don't do this, then I think there is a craving. There is a craving for being in a world that's not this practical, a world totally explained by science and totally controlled by ourselves. There's a craving for a spiritual existence. And if we don't engage that spiritual life in some way, I think we're going to find objects. People find alcohol as a way, maybe, of having rituals so that they drink at a certain place, or drink certain drinks or whatever. There can be a lot of ritualism around it. And so we go to something which is symptomatic, which is problematical, and it doesn't give us what we're looking for because it's not the real thing. That is an addiction. So in a way, an addiction is a ritual behavior that is empty, and it's a substitute for real ritual that really would take us beyond ourselves.
It's so interesting that you recognize that, because I found my own self when I get caught up in the world and I forget about my spirituality, I literally find myself craving something and I don't know what it is that I'm craving.
That's right.
And it's that thing. It's that in touch with self, I guess.
Well, it's a substitute. The thing becomes the object, like alcohol, can become a substitute for something which is really part of the spiritual life. They're very, very close.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
So we got a few minutes left. Is there something you want to talk about that we haven't talked about yet?
Well, I'll mention what I've been working on.
Okay.
I have three books coming out in the next year. The first one is called Writing in the Sand, which is my take on the Gospels. I haven't written about the Gospels before. I studied them when I was a young man, and I've been writing a lot about Greek mythology and Zen Buddhism. But I finally decided to write about the Gospels, so I have this book coming out in April that is a little book that that tells, you know, my view of how we could read the Gospels, and especially to see their spirituality and rather than the moral teaching. And I have a book of golf stories coming out, just short stories, all set on a golf course. And the stories have a little, you know, they have meaning in them, but they're not teaching stories. They're just stories that I hope will be enjoyable, and there are some ideas in them. And then I'm just finishing up a book on the soul of medicine, and I've been working in hospitals and going to medical schools now for many years, and working with hospices, trying to get a sense of how we could bring some soul into the medical practice.
That's very interesting to me. I don't know about my golf, because I don't know anything about golf, but I sure would like to interview you on that one when it comes out. So do you find that doctors are in the hospitals are accepting of spirituality, are becoming more accepting of spirituality in their practices?
Yes, I do. I find as I've traveled a lot, I've gone to many hospitals and medical schools in several countries, and my impression is that doctors are becoming more open to it, understanding it more, wanting to have more understanding.
Are they recognizing that the soul plays a part? And I have my best friend is a surgeon here in Atlanta, and she's very spiritual and very intuitive, and she takes a lot of flack about it from her peers.
Yes. Well, I was going to say, the other side of it is, I don't think that's the majority that's interested in it. But, in fact, when I go to hospitals sometimes, negative response from, especially from people like surgeons and people who are very involved in the technical aspect. My sense is that they're so proud of their technical expertise, which is wonderful. I mean, I'm alive because of it, and I fully appreciate it. But they're close to this bigger vision, and that's unfortunate.
Yeah, I interviewed somebody not too long ago, and I can't think of his name, but he wrote a book called The Scalpel and the Soul. Have you heard about it?
Yes, I read that book. It's excellent.
It was amazing what that man learned in his life, I think.
He's a good one of those examples of a surgeon who really understands the bigger picture and what he's doing, and has allowed himself to ask those tough questions.
Well, tell us one more time where to find you, your website.
You find me at careofthesoul.net. Careofthesoul.net.
And your books are all available at Amazon, or can they get them straight off your site? You have tapes as well, don't you?
Yes, I do, but I don't sell things off my website.
Okay.
I just can't manage it yet. I've got too much going on. But you can get almost everything off of Amazon, yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Moore, for coming on my show. I appreciate it. And I just want to tell you, your books was very valuable to me in my
so
dark night of the
that.
Soul. I can't tell you how much, because it was like pointing the finger, yes, somebody understands how I feel.
That's right. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I know it just because I've been through it.
Thank you, and thanks for the courage to put it on a piece of paper.
Okay, well, talk again.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health. Integral Health. Integral Health. You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m. to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Harris.